On the line now, I've got Peter Fitzsimons. Peter is the author of a brand new book, well, a couple of weeks it's been out, called The Last Charge of the Australian Light Horse. Morning, Peter. How are you?
Good morning, Tim.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. Now, this book, we've spoken many times now about different books that you've written. This, the latest, came out the 1st of November, so just under a fortnight ago.
Yeah, I love this book, if I may say. I suppose every author loves their book. I love this. I love the story of this book. I mean, I'm stunned by the abilities of the Australian Light Horse, what they achieved. And, you know, I suppose I've got a personal interest in that my grandfather, Trooper Frederick Harper Bees, was in the original Light Horse back in the Boer War, which is where they really established their reputation. And it was because they were so strong in the Boer War that, come the First World War breaking out, the Imperial Government in Britain, you know, among their first requests from Australia was, we need men, we need horses, we need the Australian Light Horse, and we need them now. And 2,000 of them were on that first contingent that first landed in Egypt, trained within the shadows of the Great Pyramids, and then when Gallipoli turned into such a disaster, within 3 weeks, the soldiers of the Light Horse were asked to go to Gallipoli without their horses, where they performed extraordinarily well.
Yeah. Now, as you say in the book, the people who were there for Australia, they came from all walks of life, didn't they?
They did. Tim, have you read the book?
I have read a précis of the book at this stage, yeah.
What do you think?
Terrific. It's one of those things, you know, we all heard about the Australian Light Horse. Near where I used to drive every day in Eastern Creek, there is a memorial to the Australian Light Horse.
Is that right? I didn't know that. I wrote the book a year ago, but I reckon there were 120,000 horses that were sent over, whalers.
Right.
That went over for the First World War, and only one came back. And yes, they were an absolutely beloved. Only one came back, and that was for the funeral of the general in charge of the Gallipoli when he was shot. They sent that horse back to be the riderless horse at his funeral down Collins Street in Melbourne.
Right.
And that horse was subsequently buried at Duntroon. Go on.
You know, on the M4 in Sydney, that and you're in Sydney, that you know, that big flyover, this flyover's left, right and centre over the top of the M4, it's right at the foot of that memorial is.
I didn't know that. I mean, they were beloved. The guts of the book is to set up, as you say, they came from all walks of life. They were generally brilliant horsemen, and those that didn't start out as brilliant horsemen became ever better. There were many that were so keen to join the Light Horse that they trained themselves up. They had to pass certain tests, but by the time they got into action on those horses, they were remarkable. A lot of them were from the outback, and soldiers and horses, and so they were remarkable for their ability in the desert to do better than any other force. And they weren't a cavalry force. What they were, the Light Horse, was soldiers on horseback, and they were trained to work in small units or large units depending on what was necessary. But the idea of the horses was to move the soldiers into position to come at the enemy from surprising angles. Once there was a breakthrough, to get well ahead, to sow havoc behind the lines, and they initially after Gallipoli, they trained, and then they pushed the forces of the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, back from the Suez Canal, which was absolutely crucial, because had the Turks taken the Suez Canal, they basically control the main artery of the British Empire in that area, and that would have been devastating. So after pushing the Turks back, then they kept going. They kept going towards first Gaza, and they kept going over the next 3 years all the way to Damascus. And it ended up being instrumental in the liberation of Damascus from the Ottoman Empire for the first time in 400 years.
Now, with this, you'd quite accept that farm boys and drovers were part of this, but bank clerks, dentists, poets, and then you've even got, name people like Banjo Patterson, the test fast bowler, Tibby Cotter, as well. So there were lots of name people in this as well, yes. Weren't there?
I love the story of Tibby Cotter. I mean, Tibby Cotter was absolutely the Dennis Lilly of his day. He was an absolutely beloved figure in Sydney and around Australia. He did his most devastating work in the 1907 Ashes campaign. And at one point, famously, I think it was the Sheffield Shield match. Maybe it was a club match, because I remember the story that he took the wicket of... He bowled Dick the Trumper, the great Dick the Trumper. And Trumper got the stump that he had broken and held up the two pieces to the crowd that roared. The idea being Tibby was so fast that he could break a stump. And it's not quite that Tibby Cotter invented the bouncer, but he certainly was one of the first to use it against the English. And he was terrified. And when the war broke out, he joined initially as a stretcher bearer and was mentioned in dispatches for his bravery under fire. The Battle of Romani was where the Australians were doing it tough against the Turks, and through the smoke and the dust and the artillery and the fire and the screams, there was Tibby Cotter with his stretcher going back and forth. And then we build up to the actual charge at Beersheba, where again we get to the climax of the Tibby Cotter story. Because what happened, the background to it is, as the Turks retreated, they ended up digging in a fortified line that went from Gaza to Beersheba, a distance of about 30 miles, 50 kilometres in the New Money. And they had this fortified, militarised line where the Turks had dug in. They had trenches, they had artillery, they had the natural advantage. They would dig in at the top of culverts so that anybody coming at them had to get over the natural barriers. And the British and the Australians and so forth attacked Gaza from the south once and were beaten back, twice and were beaten back. And the third plan was, okay, we're going to change tack. Instead of attacking Gaza and being beaten back for the third time, let's go right to the far end of the fortified line, which is Beersheba, right out in the desert. And the reckoning of the Turks was they couldn't attack with any force out there, because there's no water there. So that we've got wells at Beersheba. There are no wells anywhere near Beersheba for them to sustain a force necessary to attack us. So we'll be okay. And one of the ways that the Allies were able to work out where the wells were, they consulted the Bible. And in the Bible, there are mention of many, many villages that used to be there that were no longer there, but their remains were. And the reckoning was, well, if there used to be villages of biblical times there, they must have lived off wells. So they set out the engineering corps to find those wells, to rehabilitate them, to get the water again. And bit by bit, by careful planning, they were able to get enough water in troughs to sustain the attacking force. And so building up to October 31st, 1917, by cover of darkness, the Brits, the Australians and the Kiwis, who were the fundamental ones, moved into position, and at dawn on the 31st of October, the big guns of the British artillery came down on the southwest of Beersheba, while the Australians and the New Zealanders moved down to the east. The Brits did their job. The artillery went in, their soldiers went in, they didn't get into Beersheba, but they quelled the guns on the outskirts of that side. And then the Australians and the New Zealanders attacked throughout the day. And the New Zealanders particularly did extraordinary work to quell many of the guns on the east. But by the time the sun was going down on the afternoon of the 31st of October, there was only one way. And that was for the 4th and the 12th Light Horse regiments to attack, to get on their horses and charge 6 miles straight at the Turkish guns. And they got themselves into position in four waves, and the command came, basically, go you bastards, and go those bastards did. And among them was Kitty Potter. Kitty Potter, who was usually a stretcher bearer, swapped positions with a mate of his. He wanted to be in the charge. He got on the horse. They charged. And the Turks were extraordinarily courageous, basically in staying with their guns. And I stood on that spot in April of this year where they were set up defending Beersheba, which is now in a huge town. But the accounts of the Turks, you know, these billowing clouds of dust coming at them from out of the hills, and from the top of the, at the front of these billowing clouds, they could see the glint of something that was shining at them. They looked closer, what it was. The sun going down behind them was shining off the bayonets of the Australians that were holding them above their heads. Basically, we are coming for you.
Yep.
And come for them they did. They overwhelmed the Turks, and in the battle that ensued, Kitty Cotter was shot and was killed, but in the end, the Australians took Beersheba, and most importantly, got the wells in Beersheba, which gave them water in that area. And once they'd taken the far end of the Turkish fortified line, it meant their forces could swing around behind. They had water to sustain their horses, and they were able to roll up that fortified line, and they took Gaza 7 days later, and then continued their push to take down the rest of the Ottoman Empire to the north.
Peter Fitzsimon, as always, thank you sincerely for your time, as with all of the books that you've reviewed for us over the past several years. Once again, just a terrific, terrific book. The Last Charge of the Australian Light Horse, Peter Fitzsimon, thank you very, very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.